sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the second and final part of a speech by Canadian journalist Barry Zwicker, given on May 16, 2010, at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California. Barry Zwicker was the first journalist in the world to go on national TV to deeply question the official story of 9/11. He's a writer, TV producer, and host, and a political and environmental activist. He was director of the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11, Phase 2, at the University of Toronto in May of 2004. I actually went to that conference, and that's when I first got really interested in 9/11. He produced the DVD, The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. And he's the author of the book, Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11. And so here he is, Barry Zwicker.
Now, what about past models of truth investigations? For obvious reasons, I exclude the House Senate so-called investigation into 9/11 and the 9/11 Commission. Fair to exclude also, I think, are the many investigations into Pearl Harbor and the Warren Commission and subsequent inquiries into JFK's assassination. Two investigations deserving the name, however, include, one, the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials, admirable in scope, mandate, and internationalism, probably an all-time aberration. Justice Robert H. Jackson, the American who was the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, made a statement worth quoting here. If certain acts and violations of treaties are crimes, Jackson said, they are crimes whether Germany does them or the United States does them. We are not prepared to lay down a rule of criminal conduct against others which we would not be willing to have invoked against us. So that's an admirably disinterested approach and a rare one. Now, the second one in South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Now, international courts come to mind, and anybody in this room who has already been looking into these things, what's possible and not, and all the legal aspects, I apologize because I'm undereducated about this and had to study it up a little bit, and I may just be covering kindergarten stuff here, I don't know. International courts come to mind as appropriate venues for hearing evidence concerning 9/11. It should be noted that the International Criminal Court, the ICC, however, is out of the question. It was founded July 1st, 2002, and cannot hear complaints of actions occurring after that date. Now, the ICC is not to be confused with the International Court of Justice, or ICJ, commonly referred to as the World Court. The World Court, based in The Hague, is a possible, if unlikely, venue for a reinvestigation of 9/11. It's the primary judicial organ of the United Nations. Its two main functions are to settle legal disputes submitted to it by states, no hope there, but, and to give advisory opinions on legal questions submitted to it by duly authorized international organs and agencies or by the UN General Assembly. Now, I hope it'll be discussed. I actually think there's some promise there. So, if a duly authorized international organ or agency or the UN General Assembly could be persuaded that 9/11 deserves investigation, one of these could ask the World Court to render an opinion. The most relevant investigation, however, in my opinion, may well be the International War Crimes Tribunal of 1967, initiated by Bertrand Russell. And Ralph Schoenemann is a giant of truth-seeking and social activism and excellent alternative radio journalism, and he was Bertrand Russell's personal secretary during the time that Bertrand Russell initiated the International War Crimes Tribunal. Now, it held 18 days of sessions in two rounds. The first round was in Stockholm, Sweden, in May, this is 1967, the second in Roskilde, Denmark, in late November. Witnesses included victims of the U.S. war machine and Americans who were cogs in the machine. This is Peter Martinson, an Army intelligence officer from Berkeley, California. He and other Americans told of torture and death during interrogations they had personally seen or participated in. In 1967, the American War on Vietnam, as I prefer to call it, the American War on Vietnam, was 17 years old, if we date its beginning from December 23rd, 1950. That was the date the USA entered the French War on Vietnam on the French side, signing an arms agreement with the puppet Bao Dai government. Of course, in August 1964, you had your major escalation justified by the Gulf of Tonkin false flag operation. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution was passed unanimously by the House of Representatives and passed in the Senate 88-2. Just Senator Gruening of Alaska and Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon voted against. The war eventually claimed 58,000 American and 3 million Vietnamese lives. Most of those deaths and that trouble could be traced back to the Tonkin Gulf false flag operation, which massively misled the American public and the world. The Russell Tribunal is relevant to us, in my opinion, in at least 9 ways. First, that it was held at all. It was not inevitable such an event would be mounted. There was no shortage of opponents and naysayers. For its existence, we must thank Russell, not least because he launched his efforts in 1966 in his 95th year, the same year he wrote War Crimes in Vietnam. I hope our movement doesn't wait until some of us are 95 to mount an international inquiry of the scope of Russell's. It appears that so far the closest we've come to what's needed is the 6-day International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 that I directed in May 2004 at the University of Toronto. There were 40 presenters from 3 continents. Much more has been learned about 9/11 since then. But even then, as Bob Bowman stated from his podium, at that time, there was sufficient evidence of treason for him to make that a public charge from his podium at that time. Now, the second thing is the timing of the Russell Tribunal. Try to relate it to 9/11 truth, the possibility of a major, honest, full investigation. The tribunal was held while the war was still being prosecuted. In other words, the hearing could be considered news you can use, except the news media chose to make the tribunal non-news. We're back to the media again. Sorry, you can hardly overemphasize this blockage that we have. We're back to the long-standing structural endemic serial malfeasance of the media. Now, this is a special 80-page double issue of the magazine Liberation for December 67, Jan 68. And as you can see, the main headline is War Crimes Tribunal, followed by Testimony, Reports, Findings. Inside, to begin, is an article by Dave Dellinger. On the first page, Dellinger writes, "The U.S. press chose to ignore most of the evidence. The New York Times correspondent did not attend on the days that ex-GIs Peter Martinson and David Tuck gave their testimony of GI tortures of prisoners, though he was in town and notified." Dellinger goes on, "Anyone who reads the documents reproduced in this issue will realize that this dereliction condemns mass media and seriously handicaps the developing American conscience, but does not nullify the work of the tribunal, which will out in the end." Here's an interesting question. Do we have today a magazine equivalent to Liberation? I don't know. I'm not hearing anybody shout out a title. Okay, somebody shouted out no. Thank you. All right, go on the web. Towardsfreedom.com. Thank you very much, Charlotte. Now, as to the timing of a 9/11 truth tribunal, any time is suitable, considering the ongoing so-called war on terror. But a particularly relevant time will be around the date of the 10th anniversary. There's an American social critic named Ray, I think, who said, "Anniversaries are reservoirs of sacred power." And at that time, and leading up to that time of that anniversary, there will be a propaganda onslaught, the likes of which you have yet to see. Supporting the fraud of the official conspiracy theory, it will be fully engorged. Expect a hail of lies. Expect a spate of CIA-sponsored false flag books. It's another category of false flag operation. Expect solemn lies embedded into the emotions of solemn commemorations at Ground Zero and elsewhere. Expect the illusory show trials, tellingly, just now in their early stages, to be extremely high profile. Expect altogether a tsunami of bullshit, including more incendiary false flag ops, possibly the sometimes predicted and dreaded 9/12. Maybe a dirty nuke in a suitcase found on a freighter in Galveston Harbor and traced to Iranians, providing the perfect pretext for war in Iran that the Israeli right has long wanted and for which, according to the New York Times, the Pentagon has extensive contingency plans. Third, the 1967 tribunal was comprised of 25 distinguished persons. Besides being convened under the auspices of Russell, a world-renowned philosopher, mathematician, author, and political activist, participating members, as they were called, included Simone de Beauvoir, Jean-Paul Sartre, historian Isaac Deutscher, and among the Americans, Stokely Carmichael, Dave Dellinger, James Baldwin, and Carl Oglesby. It would seem for the 9/11 Truth Movement to draw up a list of equally distinguished people today, sounding out those able and willing to be members of a 9/11 Truth Tribunal is, well, it's time. Past time, probably. Now, fourth, the tribunal that Russell set up was thoroughly international. Russell, of course, was from England, de Beauvoir and Sartre from France, and I've named some who hailed from this country. The other participants were from Austria, Cuba, Denmark, Italy, Japan, Pakistan, Scotland, Sweden, and Turkey. Fifth, the tribunal hired its own investigators who traveled to Vietnam, and the aforementioned giant for truth, Ralph Schoenemann, was sent to North Vietnam, and he wrote a first-hand substantial report in April 1966, which is published as an appendix to this book, War Crimes in Vietnam. Now, the 9/11 Truth Movement already has a substantial core of investigators. I'm looking at some of them. In the physical and social sciences, with sufficient finances, it could fund them and others. So keep buying those lottery tickets. Sixth, as mentioned, the tribunal succeeded in hearing firsthand testimony from victims and perpetrators. Besides the 23-year-old Martinson and the 25-year-old infantryman David Tuck, there was Donald Duncan, who had been an instructor in interrogation techniques at the U.S. Army Special Warfare School in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And it is fascinating to read what he says about the way that they taught the American soldiers to torture, but right in the classes, because they told them the Geneva Conventions prohibited this. They said, now, this is what you're not supposed to do because you would be breaking the law. You would do this waterboarding, all these techniques, and this is what you're not supposed to do. This is what we're telling you. Don't do this. Seventh, the preparations for the tribunal, including Russell's book, and the questions raised in the sessions took into account the broader context of the Cold War and American imperialism, as well as more restricted but still important questions such as whether U.S. actions in Vietnam constituted genocide. It was determined they had. And whether there was complicity on the part of the governments of Japan, Thailand, and the Philippines, the verdict was mixed on that. Now, presumably, an inquiry into 9/11 could not fail to explore its international ramifications and links to the arms industry, big oil, intelligence agencies in the USA, Israel, Britain, and elsewhere, and the geopolitical plans and practices of the Anglo-American Alliance and other players. But because 9/11 has been such a far-reaching and pivotal historical event, some limits would need to be placed on the mandate. Eighth, the Russell Tribunal probed specific questions. These concerned, for instance, the use of weapons and products such as white phosphorus and lazy dog scatter bombs prohibited by laws of war, and whether there was deliberate, systematic, and large-scale bombing of civilian objectives. In all, 10 specific subject areas were addressed. Organizers of a 9/11 tribunal should have little difficulty in defining particular areas for investigation. Now, the ninth relevancy and final one is not a parallel for a 9/11 tribunal, but rather is a question that will face the organizers of a major 9/11 reinvestigation. It's so complicated that I can only touch upon it here. Tribunal members, whether there are 2 or 25, must be substantial, preferably distinguished. Now, the question is, are only allegedly objective persons with no preconceived notions about 9/11 to be sought out to serve as tribunal members, to have no opinions about 9/11 going on 10 years after the events is to be distinguished, but not in the usually accepted sense. But if only known and distinguished truthers are selected to serve, such as David Ray Griffin, you can already hear the outcry. The selection process would be pilloried in order to denounce the whole exercise as an anti-American setup or worse. It's a very tricky challenge. Russell set up a whole series of further tribunals that examined alleged crimes over much of the world. These met in the 70s and 80s. In 2003, the Russell Tribunal model was adopted by the World Tribunal on Iraq, held to analyze the Project for a New American Century, the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the subsequent occupation of Iraq, and the links between these. How many ever heard about that tribunal? Right. I just happened across it on the internet because of the neighborhoods in the internet that I visit. In 2004, there was a Brussels, B.R. Russell's Tribunal with the capital B.R. in tribute to Bertie. It took place in Brussels as a continuation of the World Tribunal in Iraq. And, commented philosopher Jacques Derrida, to resuscitate the tradition of a Russell Tribunal is symbolically an important and necessary thing to do today. Of course, Derrida is prominent in the postmodernism movement, and a lot of people don't like it, but that's too bad. To the extent that I, for one, am hopeful, my hope rests on two broad categories. First is the ongoing work of people in this room and others like us all over the world. And we should not underestimate how many there are. There are so many people in projects, from David Ray Griffin to We Are Change, that one hesitates to single out one. Nevertheless, Peter Phillips spotlighting what he calls the truth emergency and state crimes against democracy, or SCAD, are exemplars. There's the positive creative work done by Carol Bruyé and others, particularly women, and the benign contributions of many people guided by spiritual wisdom. My second hopeful category is much harder to describe, and it's equally the basis for my worst fears. This gets pretty arcane. Call the category trends and developments. Trends and developments over which we in this room and others like us all over the world have little control. Developments include the collapsing ecosystem, massive die-off of other species, unsustainable depletion of renewable and non-renewable resources, a still-growing human population living increasingly in megalopoli, and the still-increasing pace of technological developments such as nanotechnology. Thank you, nanotechnology, for super thermite. I find hopeful a trend toward national political coalition building. See Britain. More talking, more negotiation, more compromise, less posturing, less bullying. I don't see Obama really as a coalition builder, but anyway. In spite of the exceptional and bad examples of Israel and Italy, coalitions tend to improve governance. In fact, we have a coalition, what we call minority government in Canada, and our right-wing prime minister, Stephen Harper, would love to grab complete control. He is a control freak. But so far, you know, we got five parties in the House of Commons, and the other parties keep getting votes. And, by the way, with our hopeless first-past-the-post system, you know, no proportional representation, somebody figured out, it was in a letter to the Globe Mail the other day, that Stephen Harper's party was elected with 18% of the Canadian votes. Bad as that is, the USA, as usual, lags even further behind. We're also seeing a counter-development, more splintering. Counter-development to coalitions. New religious outcroppings, sects, militias, fads, paths to personal or collective salvation or survival are emerging. This is all typical during societal collapse. There's also a small but unmistakable trend toward greater accountability. And because of Google, YouTube, WikiLeaks, and generally the mushrooming data cloud, and with privacy, a partial casualty, we're seeing more outings, more accountability for the likes of politicians, corporate executives, Roman Catholic bishops, and even the Pope. But an overemphasis on certain kinds of accountability can draw public servants into wasting large amounts of time poring over expense accounts in search of an occasional strip club receipt, which the media will then seize upon to distract the populace for a week. It's much larger accountability that's needed, accountability for the likes of SCAD. Now, in this revelations and accountability drama, there's an invisible player, the vast spook establishment. It continues to succeed in protecting itself from transparency, continues to execute its dirtiest jobs well hidden. These include their data harvesting from Google, YouTube, and generally the mushrooming data cloud. Long ago, Google, originally a private company with retired CIA executives on its board, has tracked every mouse click. By the way, at one time, the Social Responsibility Roundtable of the American Library Association issued a paper about Google in its early days. And it's an interesting paper. The CIA, NSA, and at least 14 other so-called intelligence agencies in the USA have a combined staffing of 200,000, and according to the New York Times, non-black budgets totaling more than $44 billion a year, annually and growing. Taken with Mossad, MI6, and the like, covert agents and so-called special forces crawl the globe like bacteria. As a matter of fact, I was talking about special forces just before. So I want to revert to language deconstruction just for a moment. I got to get this off my chest. You're going to see a slide of a tank which happens to be in Basra, Baghdad, and there's a soldier leaping out of the tank on fire. He's been hit with a Molotov cocktail. He lived. And that tank had in it British soldiers who made a full-fledged raid on the jail in Basra. After the Basra police had stopped a Toyota Corolla that had two guys in it dressed as Arabs who were actually British special forces, and the car was loaded with explosives and it was heading toward a market. So these guys were members of a black ops unit called the British Army's Special Reconnaissance Regiment, or SRR. And such units are almost always referred to in the media as elite. It bugs me. As in the U.S. Army's elite special forces. Whereas their bloodthirsty characters and crimes against humanity and peace justify them being described as uncommonly vicious, psychotic, criminal, moral scumbags for hire. Now, I'm opposed to name-calling. I'm just describing them. Now, back to these various developments. As I mentioned, this is all part of my sort of hope and fear combo. They're all part of or contributing to meta-developments. Now, these meta-developments include speed-up. A speed-up is a very important phenomenon, and I think it was Marshall McLuhan who first raised the concept and educated about it. I was privileged to take his class for 3 years. And the other development I call scale-up. So what we have now is both speed-up and scale-up. An example of both at once was that record market drop and rebound, what scuba divers call a bounce dive, on May the 6th. You must all know about it. Now, a contributing reason, by the way, for that historic drop in the stock market and the rebound was automated trading. So big corporations, big financial and industrial corporations, have automated trading. They got algorithms and so on. They just dip into the digital pool of wealth on Earth, which is created by people's intellectual and physical labor, and they just scoop it out in an automated way. They've been having a drink while they're making their money. Talk about an edge for the super rich. And it gives a whole new meaning to the term money machine. Now, another meta development, well, in my opinion, is ungovernability. There's a growing agreement many countries and some states and even some cities are too large and complex to govern as they were in the past. As far as I can make out, all that's holding the American empire together at the moment is military might, covert activities, and the persistence of illusion. I don't think it's really being governed much. Now, here's a meta musing. We may be experiencing the emergence of a planetary survival ethos. If we are, it's being enabled by instantaneity of communication and feedback among wired and wireless millions of gadget-attached humans, comprising what Peter Russell in his 1982 book and film described as the global brain, a metaphor for a worldwide intelligent network formed by people and meshed with information and communication technologies, connecting them into an organic whole. Arguably, a global superbrain is now evolving. Ideally, it enables people, as one of Peter Russell's colleagues puts it, to find out what they need to know rather than what they think they need to know. Well, this is a lot of words from me. In toting up all these dangers and problems and uncertainties, and then tacking on at the end a stab at a semi-mystical promise, I'm reminded of Mark Twain's description of Nevada City when he first arrived there. There were, he said, military companies, fire companies, brass bands, banks, hotels, and theaters, hurdy-gurdy houses, wide-open gambling places, political powwows, civic processions, street fights, murders, inquests, riots, a whiskey mill every 15 steps, a dozen breweries, a half-dozen jails and station houses in full operation, and some talk of building a church. Perhaps less mystical is that if Peter Russell is correct in recognizing a global brain, it must be evolving, growing electrosensory parts, such as citizen video, the internet, Facebook, Twitter, WikiLeaks, and even the ubiquitous surveillance cameras, think Mossad assassins in Dubai caught on video. And we know our brains are physically changed by our sensory intake. So something's happening. Whatever progress we make with conscious evolution is taking place within these trends and developments that I mentioned. And that all is taking place within a thickening infosphere. Now, besides a failing ecosystem, the biggest black swan swimming closer is that the current industrial, commercial, and financial system is unsustainable. Speed up being what it is, a few days from now the world economy may collapse. But say it's months or years. It would still be huge, and in historic terms, happening in a flash. It seems to me the greedsters, power trippers, and psychopaths, ignorant or dismissive of history, have really built a house of cards. And that's what Ronald Wright says in his book, Three Big Things Happen That Bring Down Civilizations. He calls it runaway trains, dinosaurs, and house of cards. And they're all related. Houses of cards are not designed to stand. Something will bring ours down. There's a need for contingency planning, and not only by survivalists. Now, there's one contingency some of us are preparing for, and I mentioned it before, and we have the resources. It's 9-12, what I call 9-12, the next 9-11. And should the current gang of dinosaurs impose on a long-suffering planet 9-12, the vast and now clued-in 9-11 truth movement should move with lightning speed to expose 9-12 for the fraud it is. And I already have a bedsheet with huge letters on it. The top half is blank, and the bottom half said, is a terror fraud. So I'm just waiting for it to happen and put it out on our front porch. So Arthur C. Clarke wrote that the two greatest failures of our time are failure of imagination and failure of nerve. To some extent, our imaginations are being pried open and expanded, and certainly at this conference. The power of crisis will surely continue, speeding up the process and expanding our imaginations further. The Sufi mystic Jalaluddin Rumi wrote, to increase your knowledge, increase your necessity. And I think he might have added, to increase your nerve, increase your knowledge. Now, we may in the real world stand where the movie V for Vendetta ends, with a populace on the street by the thousands, all wearing Guy Fawkes masks, fully informed now that we have been hoodwinked by the rot, corruption, and death-dealing at the core of the deep state, by the subservient mass media, and by false flag operations. But the movie's makers left completely up in the air what the populace is going to do, how that populace will reorganize society now that they have had the scales removed from their eyes. And I say, finally, speaking to our strategy, I think we should consider that of the U.S. Space Command in its DOD Joint Vision 2020 document. It calls for, quote, full spectrum dominance, unquote, over, quote, all land, surface, and subsurface, sea, air, space, electromagnetic spectrum, and information systems with enough overwhelming power to fight and win global wars against any adversary, including with nuclear weapons preemptively, unquote. Now, except for the last part, I like the sheer ambition of it. Maybe we could adopt the DOD's can-do spirit in our struggle against the diaboligarchy, which is a suitable label for a system that would plot an aggressive, imperialist, militaristic imposition of full-spectrum dominance and unselfconsciously call it a vision. On our side of the full spectrum, this is no time for surplus powerlessness. Hit them everywhere. Replace power with truth. Replace hate with love. Replace fear with courage. Project resistance and inspiration across the electromagnetic spectrum and over the back fence with your neighbor. And if a new, safer, saner world, we can't hope for a new Jerusalem. Just a Plan B world. And if we get that safer, saner Plan B world, the 9-11 Truth Movement, by reaching beyond its grasp, will have made a worthy contribution toward bringing it out. Thank you.
You've just been listening to the second and final part of the speech given by Canadian journalist Barry Zwicker at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference on May 16th, 2010 in Santa Cruz, California. If you missed the first part of the speech, it will be posted shortly on the website radioforall.net. You can also go to the understandingdeeppolitics.org website to see the complete video of the conference. This concludes this edition of 9-11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.